Welcome to the Industrial IoT Spotlight, your number one spot for insight from industrial IoT thought leaders who are transforming businesses today, with your host, Eric Walenza.
Welcome back to the Industrial IoT Spotlight podcast. I'm Eric Walenza, CEO of IoT One, and I'm joined today by Dr. Kristin Sosulski. Kristin is a data visualization professor at NYU Stern School of Business, as well as an author and speaker on the topic. And today, the topic at hand is going to be how management can make use of data visualization technologies to derive insight and make decisions based on the absolute surge of data that IoT systems are now providing them. And of course, the systems are only providing them this data in theory in many cases. So the data exists somewhere in a database, but without proper data visualization solutions, management is often unable to make decisions or able to make decisions only with a big time lag. So unable to make real-time decisions based on the data. I hope you enjoy the conversation and I look forward to your feedback. Kristin, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today about data visualization.
Thank you, Eric. I'm so excited to be here.
So, Kristin, I've given a quick intro to you already in the intro, but maybe before we launch into our conversation, you can just take a quick moment to introduce your recently published book, Data Visualization Made Simple, as kind of a foundation for our conversation here. So here we'll be talking about the role of data visualization, how visualization is changing through the adoption of new technologies and the impact that that has on our relationship to data, data visualization across times, across different audiences and formats, and the importance of establishing a data practice in your organization. Maybe ground us in your background. What was the inspiration for publishing this book? Why is this important at this point in time?
Absolutely. So data visualization is an essential skill required in today's information-rich world. And from anyone from like interns to MBAs to managers, it is a leadership skill. And through, you know, my teaching and a professor at New York University Stern School of Business, my students have actually challenged me to create the business case for why visualization needs to be part of a firm's practice. And I'm so passionate about this stance on being able to communicate insights from data clearly across the organization, from data folks to non-data folks. And it's really as simple as that. And so my motivation comes from my really passion for education and to democratize the access to information within an organization to improve everyone's decision-making and ultimately, if you think about it, the customer experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the most pervasive topics that comes up is capturing data, breaking down data silos. All too often, the topic then of actually making this data accessible to the human beings that need to make decisions based on it is not a significant part of that conversation. So it's okay, are we capturing the data? Are we able to analyze the data? But then when you talk to the operators or the people that are supposed to be making business decisions or operational decisions based on this data, they often are kind of caught in a last mile problem where they then don't have really sufficient access to this data at the time that they need it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to not only have a visualization practice, but establish a data practice and build that into the culture of your business, which, I guess we could talk about a little later.
So let's start with this kind of foundation of the role of data visualization. So how do you think, when you're communicating to your management students, how do you think through the different roles of data visualization in a modern organization?
Well, first off, I always want to compliment you on your question. Like first recognizing that there are different roles. That's like the first step, right? Like there's different roles for the use of data graphics in an organization. So it can be anywhere from exploration. So when you're trying to build a data understanding or understanding of your data, a lot of times we use visualization to be able to spot like correlations and spot trends and have those preliminary insights that help us build our questions that drive our analysis. And so data exploration is a much different activity, as you know, than data modeling. And data modeling, there's many visualizations that help us, you know, like different correlation matrices and such that allow us to better understand the accuracy of our models and so on. And so those data graphics are used for a specific purpose. And then we go to like, how do we use data graphics for decision making? And there you're communicating to a broader audience, right? So data analysis to managers and how managers can easily interpret data graphics to make decisions that have like, you know, the most important information today, right? And so there's different parameters and different inputs that are required for that, and also different visual cues that we can use for that. Probably going to have much more simpler displays, ones that really just show the key information that's needed to help those in their roles within the organization. And then there's the idea of presentation, right? So you're not just using inputs to understand what's happening now in an organization, but you might be trying to predict what might happen tomorrow. And so in that case, you're really building the case for, you know, why your predictive models are showcasing that there are going to be new markets tomorrow and how we have to act now, for example. And so when you're building pitches using visualization to show the evidence of the data and all that strong analysis that you've done is critical. But people's eyes are going to glaze over when you start talking stats immediately. And so what you want to do is use the visual as really evidence, like pretend that you're really seeing a table of numbers, but you're really seeing a data graphic. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, I think this makes sense, but maybe we can break down a couple of these and contrast them. So if we consider maybe data visualization used for exploration and then used for making very specific decisions, and so we have these different purposes, how would you then advise a company in terms of the structure of the visualization or who might be working with that to accomplish these two different purposes?
Well, one is that we need folks to have an understanding of the data and what that data represents in the real world for the business. That requires like an understanding of all the different, you know, columns and rows within your data structures. And to be able to see if the questions that, you know, are posed, say, by management are actually something that we can answer with the data. And so that's a different type of skill than one in which we are, you know, presenting the results of an analysis to a broader audience. And that requires really, well, let's think about how as humans we retain information. Let's think about humans, how we can perceive these various data graphics and their encodings. For instance, if we're talking about like a lay audience, we may not want to show data graphics like histograms or box plots or parallel coordinates or things that might be more statistical in nature or more complex. We want to show data graphics that are easily interpretable. It's not about trickery here or complexity. It's about showing the key insight and using, again, that to provide evidence. So that's really the difference.
Clear. So to an extent, we're telling stories, but we're telling them to different audiences for different purposes, and we need to then couch them in different formats. We also have recently kind of a surge in a new technology that's allowing us to visualize data, on the one hand, in different ways, visualize different types of data or mixed data sets that previously we didn't have accessible, and also view them on very different formats. Talk to us a little bit about the change that you've seen in terms of data visualization technology and how we then, as organizations and as people, interact with that in the past, maybe, you know, 5 years and 5 to 10 years. And then do you see significant change on the horizon in terms of how we're interacting with data?
Absolutely. I mean, so there's a lot of questions there to unpack, but why don't we start about like some of the changes? And, you know, in my book, I talk about like two major trends that are taking place that are affecting the field of data visualization. Like one, which you mentioned earlier, is storytelling, this emphasis on data stories. And why? Because we understand that data is just on its own is pretty much meaningless. And so we have to transform that data into information and hopefully knowledge that someone can act on. And doing that, we can situate that in the context of a story, especially when we want to be persuasive or we're making a pitch or we're presenting something that might be, you know, futuristic, like a prediction, rather than just reporting on the past, right? So I always think the most boring data presentations are when I just learn about the past and there's no suggestion about what might happen in the future, right? It's just simply a report. But those ones that are particularly compelling are the ones that like inform you and inspire you to take action of some way. So that's one thing that has definitely changed with the field of data visualization. The second is this ability to create interactive data graphics. So now I don't always have to rely on, say, the presenter to have a presenter-driven story. Now there's audience-driven storytelling. And if you think about that, I can input some data into a data graphic, like my zip code or like my gender or something about me. And I can see the output of that on how that relates to, you know, my own personal narrative. So if I want to look at, you know, how people spend their time, you know, by the there's a lot of like, you know, interesting visualizations about how people spend their time conducted by the US Census. And I might choose like female between a certain age range, you know, who is employed. And I might see how like all females within my age range like spend their time, you know, working versus exercising versus watching movies, all those different things. So now that information is made much more meaningful to me because I can explore it through the lens that I choose. And that lens is a little narrow, right? Because the designer of the data graphic, you know, picks those filters that you can use to explore. But that's creating experiences now. And, you know, one thing that, you know, I do a lot of training, consulting and teaching around data visualization. Believe me, there's plenty of work to go around because you're asking, you know, statisticians in one way to become interactive graphic designers. If you really think about it, to think about the holistic experience and to think about an audience in such a different way than we ever have before when presenting, you know, different data graphics. And so I think this is like a huge opportunity to, you know, almost have a two-way conversation with our audience. It's a much more powerful way to actually learn from the data and to encourage this line of inquiry anytime we present a data graphic. But it also requires that, you know, that the audience is mobile. When they're in front of us, we're not going to allow them to have that interactive experience. Otherwise, you know, why do we even have to be in the room? And so there's a lot of different, like, you know, considerations one has to make in terms of the format of a data graphic, like whether it's on your, you know, on your little watch, or it's designed for desktop, or something that's going to be printed as a report that I can read, you know, on the subway, or is it going to be something that I need to be present for a live presentation? So lots of different considerations for that.
Yeah, the immediacy of data is now an interesting feature. So one of the things that we try to do when we're running a workshop is we'll often try to have a quick 30-second, 1-minute survey of the participants, because having that immediate input and being able to see on a screen, so if everybody's maybe using a WeChat app and voting through their mobile phone, but then they can then all of a sudden have a little bit of insight into the experience of everybody else in the room. And somehow that is, because it's immediate and it's, you know, related to the people that are directly in their vicinity, it's more impactful than if we just said, here across China are the average, you know, results from a survey that we did last month. Or, you know, if we're looking at visit Alibaba or something, and they have a great visualization where they can show in the past 24 hours how much traffic has gone through their servers and how much e-commerce has gone through their sites, and being able to see that this actually occurred in the past 24 hours, this is kind of real-time data. It's much more impactful, again, than saying in the past year, on average, per day, we did this much volume. So somehow this immediacy of data also has a very different impact than looking at, let's say, averages that are then just kind of brought down to a particular unit of time.
Absolutely. I mean, the immediacy adds this this notion of privilege, right? I'm seeing this special information right now that, you know, how many people could be seeing at this one moment. And I think it's adding a level of intimacy into an organization or a phenomena that wasn't possible before. So we're actually getting closer to, you know, what's happening now, as opposed to kind of like really reflecting on like trends that happened in the past. And I think this is like so powerful, and how we start using this information and expecting it in some regard. It's definitely going to change, you know, I believe us as humans, just like our behaviors and how we consume information and how it affects the scale and pace of our everyday activities.
Before we move on, just reflect quickly on this. You mentioned earlier the ability also of data. You know, data is not good or bad, true or false. Hopefully it's somehow true, but the story can be to an extent manipulated. It's told to us through a story. We have right now unfolding, kind of a great case study here, which is the midterm elections in the U.S. And you know, now if you look on any online media in the U.S., there's going to be visualization kind of in real time of results coming in. And over the past couple months, we've had different organizations telling different stories with different data points without getting kind of overly political left or right here, but just kind of the context of data in an environment where it is used to convey a message and kind of win an argument to an extent. How do you kind of perceive this? Because this has been quite powerful, whether we're looking in the political domain or as an investor, an early stage startup, kind of selectively choosing data, fitting them into a story in order to secure their next round of investment. You again have this really powerful and modestly, manipulative, you could say, use of data to convey a message.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Right. So, I have a couple of points. So my first point is, as a data graphic designer, you are in complete control of what you show and what you don't show, what you present, how you present it, right? Do you show all the information, a partial story, and actually how you visualize the data specifically? It's really easy, even though it might be computer generated, to lie with data and to manipulate that and to have the graphics look as though they are presenting reality when in fact they don't. Anyone who's a novice at creating data graphics and that has, evolved in their practice and is more of an expert today knows that it's very easy to make mistakes with data. So if we know that we can accidentally do it, we can definitely do it on purpose. And we can definitely create data stories that serve our purpose. Data could be used to advertise, to persuade, and to promote. And, that's part of the power of it. We're providing evidence. Now we have to think about the context in which that data was collected, the ethics that were used to collect that data, the privacy of the participants who contributed that data, and so on. So there's a lot of ways and lenses we can look at it, especially when we're talking about using data for political purposes. But the key here is to point number one is that we often think that, we created a data graphic and it's kind of out of our hands. But the point I want to make is that the designers are in complete control and completely responsible for what's shown. And they should 100% know what that information means and what it means in the real world and try to figure out what the impact's going to be of that. The second point I want to make is in part of my book, actually, there's a professor of political science at Columbia University who has actually written a small case for my book. And it's called Policy, Mood, and Partisan Control of the Presidency. And he talks about and he shows a visual that shows the different cycles that public opinion takes with respect to demand for liberal versus conservative policies. For some of us, things might be looking up as we get towards, more conservative policies. The momentum usually changes to more liberal ones. And we've seen that year over year. And he shows that as evidence in my book through a data graphic. And so that should be, reassuring to some, but also to kind of be able to reflect on what the things that are happening now in terms of every single number, every single input that we're getting and reporting on the status of the midterm elections and all these things, that they will add up to a whole at some point. But at some point, I don't think we always have the whole information. And we might be looking at certain distinct data points, but we don't necessarily have, the entire population represented in that. And so being able to kind of couch that in these different historical theories is pretty important. And we can look back on things that, have been visualized about the different policy mood of the nation and how that's changed, from Obama onward.
You'd mentioned that the creator of the visualization is kind of in control of the story. They're in control of what they share. in the political context, also in the business context, we're then in a situation where we're constantly being presented with storylines backed by apparently, you know, seemingly very viable data that is often telling very contradictory stories. What suggestions do you have to our listeners as consumers of this data to be more effective? Because then, you know, of course, we then have a responsibility as voters or as business decision makers to also up our game or improve our ability to translate the data that we're receiving into, you know, rational decisions, so that we're not just, you could say, only accepting the story that is being told to us, but also kind of combining, you know, different stories or providing our own input into that storyline to enrich it. I think we certainly have in some contexts right now, a bit of an overload where we're trying, you know, we're grappling with the challenge of how to process all of this data and be able to then make rational decisions out of it. So maybe from the perspective of the receiver, what advice would you have?
So there's this whole field called media literacy, and it's been around for a really long time. And, you know, this really studies the impact of messaging through media on our culture and how to decode what is being said, you know, truth from, you know, let's say fiction, or a way to develop a critical eye for the information that is communicated to us, and not always to take that at face value, but to evaluate that in terms of a larger context, right? And, you know, more and more, it's such a good question, Eric. I feel like we all have to just have a set of research skills. And so, you know, like, you know, I have a doctorate, like I've done research. And so, like, what do you learn when you're a researcher? Like, you know how to sample from a population, and you know what a good sample is, and you know what a bad sample is. You know what a representative sample is, and you know one that's not. And being able to understand these basic principles will be able to, you know, to develop this critical language that we so very much need in order to kind of decode all this information that we are consuming and the integrity of it. For anyone, anytime you're looking at a data graphic, like, look at the source of the data graphic. If there's no source, you have no idea where that information came from. So that's like step one. If there's no source, like, you shouldn't trust it. And then if you also see there's a source, is there a date? From what time frame is this from? And so if somebody's showing you something from 1993 trying to talk about now, that's a point of critique and question. And so these are just some starting points, but I think this, you know, this begins to answer your really, really difficult question.
Let's bring this maybe a little bit more closely now into the context of the industrial internet and the way that data is being used here. And here we have, I think, an interesting dynamic where on the one hand, we have large data sets over time across regions that can be presented up to senior management for longer term decision making, for, you know, towards middle management for more ongoing decision making, and also to operators on the ground for really real time reaction to data. And here, we're often looking then at data that's coming from the same sensors or the same systems, but the data that people are interacting with is over different time periods, over different geographic regions, and it's certainly presented to them in very different ways. So if we use, I know ThingWorks as an example, and let's say they are working with Caterpillar or somebody, and so they want to be kind of presenting this data up to Caterpillar's executive management. They also want to be presenting it to the actual, to the maintenance teams that are doing, you know, maintenance and responding to real-time orders. How do you think in the context of this organization in terms of structuring the data and putting it in the right place at the right time, in the right format for each particular audience, you know, out of the, you know, you could probably segment a large organization into really dozens of different distinct audiences that have different data requirements.
Yeah, I think it's called magic. and perfection, right? And so, I mean, it really depends upon like your organization, right? So like if you already have a culture where you have like equitable like data access and you also have like your data isn't siloed, and you're able to, you know, leverage the use of all of these like nice BI or business intelligence tools, like you can do this really easily, right? You can set the access levels and you can build like different reports that make sense for the users. And, but like one, it's not just like build it and walk away and hope people are going to make sense of the information. It's like, it's about incorporating that into the practice of reporting. So anybody that's like on the ground using this information, like day to day, to the managers that they're reporting to, you know, the business unit, VPs and C-suite executives on how, they use this information and why it's important. And I think that's like the biggest component of this is figuring out what is the most important information and how best to communicate that to help with decision-making. And then also when reporting back up, what's the most important information that, you know, management needs to know, and, you know, circle back that this information is actually being used, you know, in the business strategy. For example. And I think having that feedback loop is really important and reinforcing. And, you know, you can jumpstart the culture by having influencers in each of the different business units and having champions for establishing this data practice and the ability to use these different data insights to make decisions, become smarter about your business.
So you'd mentioned earlier this concept of a data practice, and I guess organizations have IT departments. They, you know, they have kind of CIO functions. They have kind of CTO functions that may overlap in some areas in terms of how technology is used internally. But none of these, I feel, at least their primary responsibility is from the user perspective. A lot of these, the IT department is offering, you know, often functioning kind of from the perspective of make sure that the infrastructure runs effectively, not so much make sure that the users are, you know, satisfied with the data that they're getting and the way it's visualized. What exactly then do you mean by a data practice, or what precisely would this look like in an organization? Where would it fall in an organization? Who would be involved? How would it be structured?
I mean, we know with like the rising popularity of like data science and business analytics, like that the skills in, you know, analysis, statistics, and data viz are like in high demand. And given that, building a strong analytics and visualization team can definitely help a firm transform their data into a unique asset, right? But it doesn't mean that you need to have your own, you know, data science or analytics team to run this, but it is a quite different task than, you know, your CTO. It's not just making sure the servers run. It's making sure that the models and the predictions that those models are outputting are accurate and reliable, right? And actionable, and that those results can then be communicated to the people that are going to be using them as inputs into their analysis and decision making. So, like by having a group that understands the data in which an organization is collecting and those things that are absent from their data collection methods that, you know, are kind of, you know, questions left unanswered because maybe they don't have access to the data or no one thought about like, let's try to collect that, or that data is siloed and it's hard to kind of merge it together. All those things are really real problems in going from being technologically savvy to being data savvy. And so knowing more about our customers and our customer actions and what they're doing is absolutely critical. Like even in higher education, like knowing like what my students are doing on their learning platforms is much more helpful than not knowing. If I know that they're accessing, you know, a lesson and watching a video that I created, that's like a data point for me. And knowing who did and who didn't, that's another data point for me. And so we're able to kind of aggregate all these data points to have a picture of what's happening today in a much more nuanced way than ever before. It's not something our CTO is going to be able to tell us. Maybe our marketing team will be able to tell us like clicks and things like that and conversions. But if we're looking for, you know, the particular like path to purchase or how customers are interacting with our platforms, that's a much different set of set of questions. We might be running A/B tests to capture that data, which is like really common in organizations like Google and Amazon, like, you know, part of their practice. To have this line of inquiry, constantly testing new ideas, running ad A versus B and analyzing the results of that. That's not something your CTO is doing. That's a combination of your data analytics team and your marketing team. This is just like the tip of the iceberg, but just thinking about the types and the possibilities of the types of questions and how you can grow your organization by learning more about your customers in the present, rather than just looking at past information just because you're able to collect it. We can actually be active data collectors within organizations. And then, I mean, then you're creating a plan of action and, you know, determine who's going to have access to the insights, how they'll be used, looking for measurable outcomes, ranking and prioritizing answers to the questions to make, you know, better informed decisions. And then you have your whole culture of use that you're trying to build. You want the access to data to be easy and manageable, right? So if it's still hard, no one's going to be looking at it. So, you know, and that means actually thinking about who's going to be using it, thinking about your audience. A lot of times we think about our audience as like customers or clients. But if you think about your audience as, you know, your fellow colleagues, like how can we make, you know, make the organization as a whole better? And that's a different type of mindset. And that's what I speak about with, you know, the culture of use. And then training is necessary on like how we use, you know, use or communicate our results and use data as evidence and how we present with charts and graphs. This seems pretty simple. Like tons of people, you know, consult on this practice, like presenting with charts and graphs, but everything by, you know, you put a chart on the screen and, you know, how many people don't talk about the charts they have on the screen these days? Or they have five of them and they only speak to two of them, or they're just meant to kind of present kind of like a pretty overview, but they're not spoken to. And, you know, the audience is left kind of like wondering, like, what did that mean? Why was I looking at that? And so all these things is like really just taking your analysis and your understanding of the data outside of your own shoes and thinking about the folks that are going to be viewing it and interpreting it, and how to design best for them. And then measuring the impact of all this, right? And knowing that what you do today is going to look very different tomorrow. And I speak about that in, which is the subtitle of my book, which is called Insights into Becoming Visual. Meaning that you just don't, it's not just like you read a book on data viz and now you're an expert. It's a practice. Just like anything, I'm a big tennis player. You know, just because I played once doesn't mean that I'm an expert at it. It's a constant struggle. So thinking about how, you know, this is the extra 20% that you put into all your data analytics work. Anytime you're working with data, figuring out how to best, you know, summarize and synthesize it for others.
Yeah, no, interesting. And also, I think for yourself, to an extent, this concept of Kaizen, you know, of kind of continuous improvement in an operational standpoint, this I think actually makes a lot of sense in terms of how we interact with data today. So if the decision-making is kind of isolated to a digital office or some particular group of people in the organization, okay, those people can develop a very deep level of expertise in terms of how to actually construct visualizations, analyze data, and so forth. But it's often the person on the ground closest to the activity that really understands what would be useful. So if I had this data presented to me at this point of time in this way, I would be able to do my job better, make better decisions, and so forth. And that information is often simply not visible to the experts, the people who are really have expertise in terms of aggregating and managing data. And so somehow we need to also get the organization at large up to a certain level where they are able to identify what data is, you know, potentially available, how that data could be visualized, and how it could be used, and to be able to kind of filter that back to advise on company strategy in terms of, or company operations in terms of what is actually made possible. So I see a lot of, I mean, this is just, I think, a constant challenge where you have a particular, almost kind of a nerd, you know, you have a brain center somewhere in an organization that is great at generating ideas and managing data, but is fairly disconnected from the endpoints of the organization where the work is getting done. And somehow we need to engage those people who might be, you know, they might be fairly, have a fairly low education base. They might be scattered in different regions speaking different languages across the world. Do you have any case studies or any kind of perspective to share in terms of how do you bring data visualization out of, let's say, out of headquarters and bring it to down towards operations, towards where work is getting done, so people are able to be more engaged in terms of what data they receive and how it's presented to them to improve their ability to do their work?
Certainly. I just wanted to make one comment before kind of jumping into that. Everything, your summary was like so fantastic. And what you're essentially saying is like, hey, there's an opportunity out there that if you're great at visualizing data, there's a huge opportunity for you on the job market right now. Because firms need this. They need people that are skilled. And it may not come from headquarters. It may be something that coming from a ground up. And that's what, you know, one of the things that I teach my MBA students is that this is really a leadership skill. If you're able to, we can run all the models and everything, but if you're able to communicate what you've done and persuade and show how you've done it in a way that's digestible and understandable, and the word I love is interpretable. I mean, that's a huge win. And so when you're talking, you know, Eric, about how we communicate through all levels of the organization, establish a state of practice. I mean, there is one case study that is in my book, which is about the gaming industry. And it's a story that really speaks to, one, data being siloed. So you might have things happening in the marketing department, and you might have things happening in the game rooms of a casino. And maybe those two groups aren't talking to one another. So that's one part of the case study. The second part is you want to make a decision about, okay, well, you know, we only have a certain amount of square footage in our floor. And we're thinking about closing down the bingo room and putting in more slot machines. Why? Well, I mean, it's a simple like numbers game. Slots bring in more money than bingo. And the case goes through like running what's called like a cluster analysis and being able to identify the different segments of our customers and being able to help like the floor manager specifically see and understand like who's actually playing bingo and what else are they playing? Who's playing slots and what other games are they playing? So if we close the bingo room, what other business are we losing? Are we also losing business in the slots? And so what's the total loss rather than just thinking about only the opportunity? And I think that's something where having a more holistic understanding of our customers is super important. Again, this is at the gaming floor level. And you know, like if you've been to a casino or even Target, right? You have things like these reward cards, right? So you put a few quarters in the slot machine, and you also put your card in, right? And I know that you're in Shanghai, so let me give you like the Macau example, like going through the win in the Macau or something, right? And like, you know, it's recording that information, and like, what else did this type of user play? Being able to kind of see that and see that on a daily basis and see how it changes from weekend to weekday. And if you're managing staff, how to staff up, how to be more responsive, how to know who's there. Do we have, you know, what they call like a big whale, like, you know, somebody who spends a lot of money? Like, do we know that they're there? And so there's lots of, at all levels, on being able to ensure that the folks who need the information are informed.
You'd mentioned also when we were chatting before the call, this online certification. I mean, I'm thinking that going through an MBA program and so forth is something that only so many people can actually make that investment. But there's, of course, other lighter ways, you know, ways for people to kind of get their foundation and be able to kind of orient. What maybe you can share a little bit of input on this and kind of help us understand who would this be useful for, or what are the other mechanisms for somebody who is not ready to dive into an MBA and devote a lot of time to this, but still kind of wants a kickstart in order to accelerate their ability to manage data.
Oh my gosh. So at NYU Stern, we are offering a certificate called Visualizing Data. It begins in February of 2019 and ends at the end of March 2019. So it's only 8 weeks. It's completely online. And there actually are some live synchronous sessions that are optional. So you actually get to, you know, talk and interact with me. It's all based on my book, but it's about what I'm calling the practice of becoming visual. So the book, you can read it and not do any of the exercises in it. I may haunt you if you don't, but you know, but the course really is what propels you into actually developing the skills, like how to build a data map and what that looks like and how to make sure that data map is representing, you know, our data in a normalized way and accurately and all that good stuff. And so we really get down to using the software, but always, you know, keeping in mind who our audience is. And so actually, like, the assignments are all about creating visualizations that represent the past, the present, and the future. And so you get the skills for understanding the dimension and the level of grain of your data and thinking about how a lot of times we always use data that's just like past data. My motive is to have people thinking about how we present predictions, how we present what's happening now, and how we situate that in the context of what happened before. And that's all about pitching. So there's lots of great, you know, interactive activities as part of that. Actually, I've written like 2 books on the online learning. So it's really one of my fields of expertise that I bring to this. But I mean, there's many other ways. And I talk about that in my book too, right? There's all these free courses that you can take. If you want to brush up, if you want to learn a little bit of a software program, you should definitely do it. And that's another thing that has really changed about data visualization. Not only is there more data, but there's more access to education that allow us to better understand data. And that access is, you know, we should definitely take advantage of those resources. We never know how the world will change. You know, right now we're in a really great spot. There's a lot of free education out there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to leave on, is that, you know, data is becoming, you know, maybe the most valuable commodity. It's something that every organization, from a Facebook through a equipment manufacturer, now has to have a level of expertise in. And there's really no excuse now. There are great programs, paid programs, free programs out there to help help people figure out how to make use of the data that they're gathering. Any last points, or can I ask you, what is the best way for, I mean, certainly we'll put the Amazon link to Data Visualization Made Simple in the podcast notes, but is there any other great way for people to reach out with you if they're interested more in learning about you, your work, or having a conversation?
Twitter is a great way. So definitely tweet me. My handle is just my last name, Sosulski, S-O-S-U-L-S-K-I. You can feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. I tend to post periodic updates of my work there. Twitter is like if you want the daily feed. And of course, like, I'm really open to email. I'm a professor. And so like, it's really in my nature to discuss and have conversations. So I'm really open to that. My email is ks123@nyu.edu.
Awesome. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for taking the time to walk through data visualization with us today. It's unfortunately not a topic we spent enough time on, but it is incredibly important in the industrial IoT.
Eric, this is really a pleasure and super fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Industrial IoT Spotlight. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IoT1HQ and to check out our database of case studies on IoT1.com. If you have unique insight or a project deployment story to share, we'd love to feature you on a future edition. Write us at eric.walenza@iot1.com.